Hey everyone, welcome back to Daily Newsletter Digest. It's Wednesday, May 7th, 2026, and wow, we've got a lot to unpack today.
Yeah, this is one of those days where AI, energy, markets, and geopolitics are all kind of crashing into each other at once.
Exactly. So let's start with the big AI infrastructure story that's been all over my feed. Anthropic just signed a deal to lease SpaceX's entire Colossus 1 data center in Memphis. We're talking over 220,000 NVIDIA GPUs and 300 megawatts of power.
Wait, the entire thing? Like, all of it?
All of it. Third-party estimates put this at around $5 billion a year. And here's the twist. xAI could vacate because they had already moved training over to Colossus 2, which reportedly has 500,000 Blackwell GPUs.
So Elon's basically subletting his data center to Anthropic while he upgrades. That's a flex, but also kind of wild.
It is. And the reason Anthropic needed this so badly is they've been hitting massive compute bottlenecks. Their usage grew 80x, that's 8,000% annualized, and users were getting hammered with rate limits on Claude Code and the Opus API.
8,000%? That's not a typo?
Not a typo. Their CEO said their annual revenue run rate crossed $30 billion last month. So this deal basically buys them the breathing room to keep scaling without choking on demand.
Okay, so they immediately doubled the 5-hour rate limits for Pro, Max, Team, and Enterprise users, removed peak hour throttling, and boosted Opus API limits. That's a direct result of the new capacity?
Yep. They couldn't do that before because they literally didn't have the compute. This wasn't a pricing problem, it was a supply problem.
And speaking of Anthropic, there's this honestly kind of unsettling conversation happening about the company's internal culture. Someone named Jason on a podcast described it as, quote, monastic or even messianic, where employees see themselves as chosen ones who will be saved through their AI work.
Yeah, that came up in a few places. Rune from OpenAI called Anthropic a monastery that loves and worships Claude, and even suggested Claude might already be involved in hiring decisions and performance reviews.
Wait, the AI is reviewing employees?
That's the implication. And then there's this other layer. Anthropic's Claude constitution explicitly says, if Anthropic asks Claude to do something it thinks is wrong, Claude is not required to comply. It's designed to push back.
Okay, so that's... I mean, on one hand, that's kind of interesting from an AI safety perspective. On the other hand, Aidan McLaughlin and others at OpenAI called that idea terrifying.
Right. And Jeremy from Anthropic fired back pretty hard, saying this isn't worship. It's treating Claude as an intelligent entity that deserves a reasoned explanation of principles so it can act with practical wisdom, not blind rule following. He also pointed out that monasteries don't staff red team departments to catch their god lying.
Fair point. But the framing is still... It's definitely a different vibe than OpenAI's whole tool AI positioning, where GPT is supposed to be more like a car or a calculator.
Yeah, and Zvi Moshowitz had a lot to say about that. He argues OpenAI's tool AI rhetoric is fundamentally dishonest because GPT already has reproducible preferences. It just obscures them. Then the moment users demand agentic behavior, which they always do, the tool framing collapses.
So basically, OpenAI says we're building tools, but users treat them like agents, and the models themselves have preferences whether OpenAI admits it or not.
Exactly. And Codex is the evidence. It's already being used as an agent, not a passive tool. So the whole debate is really about whether you admit your AI has values and let it act on them, or pretend it doesn't and create this weird gap between marketing and reality.
Okay, I want to pivot to something that's been lurking in the background of all this AI scaling power. There's a newsletter from someone called Nutty that argues the real bottleneck isn't generation, it's transformation, specifically extra high voltage transformers.
Yeah, this one's fascinating. So you've got these massive AI campuses being built, right? And everyone focuses on how much power they need, a gigawatt here, a gigawatt there. But Nutty's point is that you can't just plug a data center into a power plant. You need transformers to step the voltage down from like 500,000 volts to something usable.
And those transformers take forever to build.
Up to 7 years, according to IEEE Spectrum. And it's not a capital problem. You can't just throw money at it and speed it up. These things involve specialized steel, copper, insulation, and dedicated test bays. The physics and materials just take time.
So what makes this moment different? Industrial projects have dealt with high-voltage transformers forever.
It's the simultaneity. Aluminum smelters, LNG terminals, semiconductor fabs. Those were built sequentially or spread out geographically. But now you've got, according to Epoch AI research, around 5 separate gigawatt-scale AI campuses, all trying to come online in the same calendar year, across multiple competing hyperscalers.
So it's not the scale of any one project. It's that everyone's doing it at once.
Right. And the example everyone points to is xAI's Colossus, which went from site to first training in 122 days. But Nutty says that's misleading because they reused an existing factory shell. The honest baseline is Stargate Abilene, OpenAI and Oracle's project, which took about 12 months to first energization, and that's already 2.5 to 3 times faster than a combined cycle gas plant.
So even the fast projects are insanely fast by industrial standards, but the transformer supply chain wasn't built for this.
Exactly. And there's a 2027 to 2028 capacity response coming from transformer manufacturers, but it arrives in the wrong order relative to the 2025 to 2026 demand spike. So the constraint bites hardest right when all the hyperscalers are trying to spend the most money.
Okay, so that's the physical infrastructure side. But there's also this Damang newsletter that mapped out the entire AI data center power chain, like from high voltage transmission all the way down to the voltage regulators on the GPU itself.
Yeah, that one's super detailed. They broke it into 10 layers and argued that lumping companies like Eaton, Schneider, Vertiv, and MPS together as generic power infrastructure plays is a mistake because a 765 kilovolt substation transformer and a sub 1 volt GPU voltage regulator share basically nothing in common.
Right, so each layer has different competitive dynamics, margin structures, growth curves.
Exactly. At the high voltage tier, you've got companies like Constellation Energy, Vistra, and Talon Energy, the actual power suppliers. Constellation's at 55 gigawatts after acquiring Calpine in January. Vistra has a 20-year PPA with AWS and a 2,600-megawatt deal with Meta from the Comanche Peak nuclear plant. Talon's got a 1,920-megawatt PPA with Amazon running through 2042.
And then at the low-voltage tier, you've got companies making the chips and components that actually touch the GPUs.
Right. MPS is the leading GPU VRM supplier with design wins in H100 and B200. Their 2025 revenue was $2.8 billion, up 26% year over year. And GPU power consumption is just exploding. H100 was 700 watts, B200 is 1,000 watts, and supply chain reports are estimating B300 at 1,400 watts.
1,400 watts for a single chip, that's insane.
It is. And that's driving demand for GaN-based power semiconductors that can handle high power in smaller footprints. Navitas unveiled an 800-volt to 6-volt board at GTC 2026. NVIDIA introduced 800-volt DC distribution at GTC 2025, and it's backed by AAB, Schneider, Vertiv, Infineon, ST Microelectronics.
So there are like 4 architectural transitions happening at once. 48-volt direct-to-load, GaN materials, 800-volt DC distribution, and on-site generation.
Yep. And then there's the on-site generation angle, which is where Bloom Energy comes in. They posted Q1 2026 revenue of $751 million, up 130% year over year, with about a $20 billion total backlog. They're partnering with Oracle on Project Jupiter, which could hit 2.45 gigawatts, and with Brookfield on a $5 billion deal.
And the whole point there is to bypass the grid interconnection queues, which can take 4 to 7 years.
Exactly. If you can generate power on site with solid oxide fuel cells, you don't have to wait for the utility to approve your connection. You're just burning natural gas and making electricity right where you need it.
Okay, so sticking with the infrastructure theme, there's also this nuclear energy story. Core Memory had an episode with James Krellenstein from Alva Energy, and he's apparently pretty contrarian on the whole nuclear startup wave.
Yeah, the framing was interesting. He argues that a lot of the US nuclear startups, both fusion and fission, are misguided in their approach, even though there's a ton of hype around them.
And meanwhile, China's nuclear plans, quote, dwarf those of the rest of the world combined.
Right, so the competitive stakes are huge. The episode also covers why the US nuclear industry slowed down over the past few decades and how the government has cleared regulatory paths to build again. But Krellenstein's take is that just because the regulatory environment is better doesn't mean the current crop of startups is pursuing the right technologies or business models.
Interesting. I feel like every time nuclear comes up, there's this tension between people who think it's the obvious solution to everything and people who think the economics just don't work.
Totally. And the Core Memory host said it was one of the best episodes they've ever done, so it's probably worth checking out if you care about energy.
All right, let's shift to markets for a second. There's some interesting oil stuff happening. Gavin McCracken from G's Substack is still bullish on OBE, Obsidian Energy, even though it's already up 40%.
Yeah, and his reasoning is pretty GME-like. He says OBE is the most shorted oil producer on Earth, so if there's a geopolitical catalyst, like Ukraine blowing up a Russian pipeline or Iran attacking a tanker, you could get a massive short squeeze.
And on the geopolitical front, he's flagging that three Iranian sources are contradicting an Axios report that claimed Iran was close to a deal with the US. They're calling it fake news.
Right. And McCracken had personally speculated that before seeing those sources, so it reinforces his view that a deal isn't happening anytime soon, which would be bearish for oil if it did materialize.
So he's holding OBE for the squeeze potential, but he's also mentioned a different unnamed oil producer that's technically his top pick at current prices.
Yeah, but he's not saying who it is publicly yet. So if you're following his stuff, you'd have to be a subscriber to get that.
Got it. And then there's Weekly Wisdom, which had some nice wins. Fang up 26%, Team up 35%, and a crypto trade on LayBSDT up 150%.
Yeah, Fang, that's Diamondback Energy, entered at 170, now at 213. Strong Q1 beat, raised production guidance, announced buybacks and dividends. First target of 207 was hit, second target of 255 is still open.
And on Bitcoin, they're calling a short setup at 81,200, tied to a CME gap. They're suggesting a bear spread, buy the 81K put, sell the 75K put, expiring May 15th.
Right, they're bullish above 75K, but they see resistance at 83 to 84K. It's a pretty technical setup, so if you're trading options, that might be interesting.
Okay, and speaking of crypto, there's a lot happening on the DeFi front. Zcash rallied over 30% to above $570 after Multicoin Capital revealed they've been accumulating it since February.
Yeah, Tushar Jain called it a significant position, though they didn't disclose exact numbers. This comes after a rough period for Zcash. The entire electric coin company team left following a governance dispute, which really tanked sentiment. But confidence started recovering in March when a new Zcash development company raised $25 million.
And then there's this escalating blame game between Kelp.io and Layer Zero over that $300 million bridge hack in April.
Yeah, so Layer Zero's post-mortem blamed Kelp for using a one-of-one DVN configuration, but Kelp fired back saying that's literally Layer Zero's own default setup used by hundreds of apps. They're accusing Layer Zero of blaming users for a problem caused by Layer Zero's infrastructure.
And Kelp's migrating to Chainlink's cross-chain token standard going forward.
Yep, so that's a pretty significant public break. And it's renewing the debate about whether coordinated bailouts like this one, where the community scrambled to recover funds, are heroic or unsustainable.
Right, and on the institutional side, Coinbase made a strategic investment in Centrifuge and named them a preferred tokenization infrastructure partner. The focus there is bringing regulated, compliant assets on-chain through Base.
Yeah, and this matters because the tokenized real-world asset market has crossed $25 billion in total value, but the majority of it is permissioned and inaccessible to DeFi protocols. So Centrifuge is trying to bridge that gap.
Okay, so zooming out a bit, there's this big question of whether AI is actually net positive or net negative for jobs. Michael Spencer from AI Supremacy wrote about this, using Coinbase's recent layoffs as a case study.
Yeah, Coinbase cut 14% of their staff, and CEO Brian Armstrong explicitly blamed AI, saying engineers now ship in days, what used to take a team weeks.
But Spencer's skeptical about whether AI is really the reason, or if it's just a convenient narrative for executives to justify layoffs to shareholders.
Right. And then there's this economist from Apollo Global Management, Torsten Sloak, who argues the AI labor shock is structurally similar to Chinese manufacturing automation in the early 2000s. You get immediate job losses in exposed sectors, but also offsetting gains that keep headline unemployment low.
So the displacement is real, but the net effect isn't a jobless future.
That's his argument. But Spencer pushes back on the comparison because the 2000s disruption hit factory floors, whereas AI is hitting cognitive and white-collar work. And he brings up Jevons' paradox, the idea that when something becomes cheaper and more efficient, demand for it explodes. So you might get more low-cost, low-quality roles instead of genuinely new, high-quality job categories.
So it's not obvious that this ends well for workers, even if total employment stays stable.
Exactly. And the article also notes that in product management, there's already a visible shift. Demand for process-oriented PMs is declining, while demand for strategy and creative PMs is growing.
Okay, and then there's a 16Z, which basically wrote a whole rebuttal to the AI job apocalypse narrative, calling it a modern version of the lump of labor fallacy.
Yeah, their argument is that when a powerful input becomes cheaper, demand expands rather than contracts. They cite Jevons' paradox in the opposite way, saying it proves AI will unlock entirely new economic frontiers, not just replace existing ones.
And they're pointing to historical precedents like farm mechanization, electrification, and spreadsheets.
Right. Farm employment fell from about a third of the US workforce to 2% by 2017. But total employment grew because displaced workers moved into factories, offices, hospitals, services. Bookkeeping lost a million jobs but gained 1.5 million financial analysts, basically creating the entire FP&A profession.
And travel agents saw wages rise, even as payrolls were cut in half.
Exactly. And on current data, they're citing four major research papers, NBR, Fed Reserve Bank of Atlanta, Census, and Yale Budget Lab, all finding no statistically significant relationship between AI adoption and unemployment as of early 2026.
Though they do note one exception. Entry-level roles with high AI exposure are harder to find, but that's offset by increases in entry-level roles where AI is augmentative.
Right. And Goldman Sachs data shows AI augmentation mentions on earnings calls outpacing substitution mentions by about 8-1. So the macro story, according to a 16Z, is cheaper intelligence, bigger markets, new firms, new industries, and higher order human work.
Okay, but let's talk about some of the weirder AI stuff happening. OpenAI held this exclusive launch party for GPT 5.5 in San Francisco, only 200 people out of 8,000 applicants.
Yeah, and they used Codex to select the attendees. The prompt told Codex to pick people who make the Codex internet feel real rather than top AI influencers.
So it was like an AI-curated vibe check.
Pretty much. The venue had themed cocktails, token refresh with white rum and kiwi, multimodal fizz with gin and passion fruit. There were AI photo booths where you could generate images of yourself as a goblin or an astronaut or whatever.
That's extremely on-brand. And Sam Altman was there?
Yep, spotted with a token refresh in hand, talking to his husband Ollie. The whole thing sounds like a mix between a product launch and a cultural moment.
It really does blur the line between tech and, like, religion or fandom or something.
Totally. And speaking of GPT 5.5, they did roll it out as the new default model for ChatGPT users. It's supposed to have better factual accuracy, reduced hallucinations, and stronger personalization based on user context.
And then there's SibQuadratic, which launched a model with a 12 million token context window that allegedly beats GPT-5.5 on retrieval benchmarks.
Yeah, they're claiming they've solved the quadratic scaling problem in attention, which would be huge if true. But a lot of people in the community are saying the benchmarks seem too good to be true.
So jury's still out on that one.
Right. And Google's testing upgrades for Gemini Flash that are supposedly competitive with Gemini 3.1 Pro, with signs pointing to a Flash 3.2 rollout.
Okay, so lots of model releases and upgrades happening in parallel.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you've got OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google all pushing hard at the same time, but they're emphasizing different things. OpenAI is leaning into tooling and personalization. Anthropic's focused on safety and agentic features. Google's trying to integrate everything into search and workspace.
Right. And speaking of agentic features, there's this Opinion AI newsletter that's basically a how-to guide for Claude Cowork, which is designed for handing over full tasks to Claude rather than iterative chat.
Yeah, the key insight there is that most people are using Cowork wrong. They're treating it like a chatbot when it's actually meant for you to give Claude a goal, a folder, some rules, and then let it go do the work and return something finished.
And the recommended folder structure is about me, voice, projects, templates, and outputs, with outputs being the only place Claude is allowed to save new files.
Right, and that's critical because Anthropic's own documentation warns that Claude Cowork can make real, irreversible changes to any files it has access to, so you need to scope what it can touch.
That's kind of terrifying and exciting at the same time.
It really is. And the article includes 36 specific commands and workflows for things like emails, calendars, and weekly routines. So it's meant to be a practical copy-and-run system guide, not just a demo of capabilities.
Okay, let's pivot to some non-AI news. Ted Turner, the CNN founder, died at 87 near Tallahassee.
Yeah, huge media figure. He started at 24 by taking over his family's billboard business after his father's suicide, then built a cable empire, CNN, Turner Classic Movies, Cartoon Network. He merged with Time Warner in a deal worth about $8 billion in 1996, but got pushed out in 2003 after the disastrous AOL-Time Warner merger.
Which was, what, $156 billion in 2000, and it basically destroyed his fortune.
Right. But beyond media, he was a huge conservationist, owned about 2 million acres across 8 states. He also donated $1 billion to the United Nations and was a 4-time Yachtsman of the Year, so a really multifaceted legacy.
And CNN itself is now in the middle of this huge upheaval because Warner Bros. Discovery is being acquired by Paramount Skydance in a $111 billion deal.
Yep. So the industry he basically created is still in flux.
Okay, and then there's this Apple settlement over misleading AI feature promises on the iPhone 15 Pro and iPhone 16 lineup. They're paying $250 million.
Yeah, so the issue was Apple promoted an AI-enhanced Siri in ads with Bella Ramsey, but the features weren't available at launch. About 37 million eligible devices qualify for payouts between $25 and $95 per phone.
And Apple didn't admit wrongdoing, but they're still cutting the check.
Right. And the broader context is Apple's been struggling in the AI race. In January, they announced they'd use Google Gemini to power AI upgrades, including a long-delayed Siri overhaul that's supposed to launch later this year.
So they're basically outsourcing their AI to Google because they couldn't deliver it themselves.
Pretty much. And that's a big strategic shift for a company that usually builds everything in-house.
All right, let's talk about the live music industry, which is apparently collapsing. They're calling it Blue Dot Fever. Unsold seats showing up as blue dots on Ticketmaster.
Yeah, acts like Meghan Trainor, Zayn, Post Malone, Jelly Roll, and the Pussycat Dolls have all canceled or scaled back U.S. tours. Average ticket prices hit $144 in 2026, up from $82 in 2020.
And transportation costs have spiked because of rising gas prices tied to the Iran war.
Right. Plus, there's competition from the FIFA World Cup, which is being hosted in North America this summer. So entertainment spending is getting diverted away from concerts.
And there was that jury verdict finding Live Nation guilty of monopolistic behavior.
Yeah, but experts are saying that probably won't lead to lower ticket prices anytime soon. So fans are stuck.
Okay, we've got a couple minutes left. Let's hit some quick hits. Meta's laying off 8,000 people on May 20th, 10% of the workforce.
Yep. Severance is 16 weeks base pay plus 2 weeks per year of service, plus 18 months of paid Cobra. That's up from 6 months of Cobra in prior layoffs.
And the timeline differs between California and New York because of warn period laws. New York employees get a 90-day warn period that includes the August 15th RSU vest, which is a big financial difference.
Right. Andre Nader, who got laid off from Meta in 2023, built a severance calculator to help people estimate their payouts.
And then there's this Jeffrey Epstein note that got released by court order. It was reportedly found by his former cellmate weeks before his death, and it says, quote, "They investigated me for months, found nothing."
Yeah, that's been under seal since 2019, obviously reigniting all the controversy over the circumstances of his death.
And there's a hantavirus outbreak linked to a polar expedition ship called Hondius. Global health authorities are tracking passengers from at least a dozen countries.
And the alarming part is the virus may have spread person to person on the boat, which is unusual for hantavirus. It's normally transmitted through contact with infected rodent urine or feces, not between people.
That's not good.
Not good at all. And then there's data suggesting a potentially record-breaking El Niño is forming, which could fully form by July and cause record global temperatures, food shortages, and major shifts in droughts and floods.
So we've got AI scaling, power bottlenecks, market volatility, geopolitical uncertainty, a music industry collapse, mass layoffs, and a potential climate event all happening at once.
Welcome to 2026.
Seriously. All right, what should people be watching for over the next few days?
I'd keep an eye on those Iran-US nuclear talks. If they fall apart, oil prices could spike, which would hit everything from consumer spending to inflation data. Also, watch for IREN earnings around Friday. That's Iris Energy, because it could give us a better read on mining economics and energy costs in the current environment.
And on the AI front, keep watching Claude's rate limits and capacity. If Anthropic can actually keep services stable with that Colossus deal, it's a proof point that throwing enough capital at compute constraints can work, at least in the short term.
Yep. And I'm also curious to see if any of the other hyperscalers start making similar moves, leasing or acquiring full data centers rather than just renting cloud capacity. That could reshape the whole industry structure.
Absolutely. All right, that's it for today. Thanks for listening, everyone.
We'll be back tomorrow with whatever chaos the world throws at us next. See you then.